Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Firstly, good evening, John.
And a very good evening to you, Ben, and hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone. Indeed, as ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is, as usual, 087-179-1032. And, of course, we're always live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and as a podcast later on, and we're also found on astronomy.ie. And as usual now, John, we're going to go for what to see in the sky. Now that the nights are closing in ever so slightly, you might notice it. No, well, maybe not. But the sun is setting about 10 minutes earlier in the evening than it did at the solstice on the, whatever that was, 21st of June, so about two weeks, yeah.
We'll go first for the International Space Station, because it has come back into our evening skies from the day before yesterday, and it's going to appear twice tonight, seemingly. And they're both late passes, one at 11:45 p.m. tonight, and it's quite low, actually, at 32 degrees, but quite bright at the same time, -3.1 in the magnitude scale. And again, if you're coming out and you're up at 1:22 a.m. tomorrow morning, you will get to see
it'll
it again.
It'll be passing over again at a higher altitude, and I think a little bit brighter, but they should be, they're both pretty reasonably good sightings, or they should be. And next week, of course, we'll bring you the times from next week's.
Yes, indeed. And
next week.
If you don't know how to spot the station, out through the back door, front door, whatever it is, point south, look up to the southwest, and it'll come in either lower or quite high, just depending on what pass is going on. But it does the same for it all the time. So once you get the hang of it, it comes in the same direction all the time. Sometimes it's only for a minute. Sometimes it can be up to 6 to 7 minutes, depending, again. And tonight's, not sure what time tonight's one is going to last for.
I'm not sure, 11:40. It starts at 11:45 p.m. I think it's a good 5 or 6 minute pass. It depends. The nearer you are to sunrise or sunset, the longer that you'll see it, because how long it you see it for depends on when it goes into or emerges from the Earth's shadow.
It's fantastic to watch, though, isn't it? It's once you know the time, get out a minute or so just beforehand, let your eyes adjust, and it suddenly comes into the sky.
And you'll see it move across the sky, assuming the clouds don't interfere, at the same apparent speed as an aircraft. But, of course, aircraft being up about 35,000 or 40,000 feet, the International Space Station is at 250 kilometers or so, and no flashing lights, of course. It moves, but it does move at the same apparent speed as the an aircraft.
And with the new runway, we're on the flight path. it's remarkable to see, and they're quite low as well. So, I mean, I don't mind it at all, to be honest.
In our part of the world, yes, I've noticed a lot more now that Runway North is in operation.
Yeah, they seem to take off from the new runway and then swing right towards the Ashbourne area in County Meath, and some of them take off and turn off a little bit sooner than others.
But some of them bank very steeply.
They do.
But what's this got to do with astronomy?
Nothing whatsoever.
Let's get to the planets.
Now, meteor showers. Do this first as well. The Delta Aquarids, and they're going to peak on July the 28th this month. Now, you will get to see them a few days before that. You can probably see, because it's going to be quite dark on the peak, where the moon will set at 11-ish, and you'll get to see up to 20 metres per hour, but the down point of that is at 3 o'clock in the morning, when it starts to get bright again, you'll start to miss seeing the meteors as well. So that's the pity about the any meteor shower as well. And we have the good ones coming up in August, which are the Perseids and the Geminids. They're really...
They're the two best of the year. One is in August and the other is in December. Yeah, in December 11th and 12th of August, usually when that meteor shower peaks.
Yeah, they're pretty good. Now, we're going to lose a couple of planets this month as well, but I'll go into these fairly first. Now, Mercury up to this has been behind the Sun for the last good while. And starting from tomorrow, you might start looking for it just above the west, northwest horizon, about 20 minutes after sunset. And it's just 23 degrees lower of Venus, to the lower right of Venus on that date. Binoculars, of course, help. And if you're looking towards the sun, make sure you have these filter things because you don't want to end up hurting your eyes as well. Venus, magnitude -4.7, is the evening star just at the moment, getting lower and lower as the month goes on, dominated in the low west in the twilight. It's dropping somewhat faster now, day by day, and it sets while twilight is still in progress. So we had a good run up to this from December time up to this. So get your telescope on Venus as early as you can, preferably during the late afternoon. Well, you will get to see it because it's pretty bright. And it's, even though it's sort of, what is it, sunlit, about 26% sunlit, but still pretty bright to see as well. And it will continue to swell in diameters and thin in phase as it drops lower, so you will get to see it. So I'll go into it in more detail in just a moment. Jupiter rises about 1 to 2 a.m. in the east-northeast by the beginning of dawn. It's shining high in the east. So that one is creeping back in, which we didn't get to see as well. Saturn, on the other hand, plus 0.8. It's in dim Aquarius at the moment. It rises about 11 p.m. and it's at its highest in the south and sharpest and steadiest in a telescope just before dawn begins. Uranus, of course, and Neptune, you'll need a telescope for those two. 5.8 in Aries for Uranus and 7.9 in Aquarius, Pisces. And it's high in the southeast before dawn begins. It's about 20 degrees east along the ecliptic from Saturn. So if you have a telescope, I've never really gone out to actively search for Uranus or Neptune, I must say. I don't know whether you have.
I have. Mm. Yes, I have seen Uranus. Actually, I saw Uranus once through my 10x50s.
Mm. Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah. Yep, so you can see it, yeah.
You can, and then once I knew where it was, I could pick it. This is my memory now. It was a good few years ago. I could pick it out with the naked eye once I knew where it was. Again, I did the same with Mercury one evening when I found that, and then I could see it with the naked eye, although one famous astronomer once told me, oh, you can't see Mercury with the naked eye. But actually, Mercury is about that can't be true because it's quite bright. It's about magnitude -0.1.
I have it here, and it is -0.9 just at the moment. And it will get a little bit brighter as the month goes on.
-0.9, yes. Yeah. Oh, that's, you can see that. But
Once it's in the minus figures, it's a good sight to see as well. So we are going to lose Mars and Venus from the night sky this month, but they will appear back in the morning skies, and we'll let you know closer to the time. Well, they let us know closer to the time when to see them as well. So that is it for the moment. Don't forget the Delta Aquarius, the end of the month, 28th.
Thank you, John. Nearer to home, of course, we have the moon. It's not currently visible from our vantage point here in Dublin, Ireland. It is a 32% waning crescent as we head towards the new moon, I should say, on Monday, the 17th, at 7:30 in the evening. But it's getting smaller and smaller. As I mentioned, it's 32% waning crescent. Not that we can see it at the moment, but it will rise in the early hours of tomorrow morning at just after 1:13 a.m., to be precise, from a Dublin point of view. At that stage, you'll be able to see slightly less of it, 30% of it, of the face of the moon. And when it's due south tomorrow at just after 9 a.m., only 27% will be visible. So it gets thinner and thinner, more of a crescent as we head towards that new moon next Monday. And when it sets tomorrow evening at 5:16 p.m., it'll be down to a 23% phase. So getting smaller and smaller very rapidly as we head towards that new moon. And, of course, the sun rises tomorrow in Dublin at 11 minutes past 5, which is 7 minutes later than a week ago, and local noon in Dublin, when the sun is due south and passes the meridian, That will be at 1:30 p.m., which is 1 minute later than the week ago. And the sun will set at 9:48 p.m., which is a whole 6 minutes earlier than it did this time last week. And as I mentioned earlier, John, when at the solstice it was setting at 9:56 or 9:57. So it's only about 10 minutes thereabouts setting earlier than it was at the solstice. But that increase or decrease, it's now 6 minutes, that'll get bigger and bigger as we head towards the equinox, which is, of course, in September. But as I mentioned, the sun, yes, sets at 9:48 p.m. tomorrow evening, and from then we'll have civil twilight until 10:37 p.m., and from that time we'll have nautical twilight until just before midnight at 11:55 p.m., and that's a whole 17 minutes earlier than a week ago. And from then we'll have astronomical twilight all night until the nautical twilight begins again on Thursday morning just after 3 a.m. So, there's no astronomical night until for another week or two, 30th of July or thereabouts. What does that mean? That means, all in all, we'll have 13 minutes less daylight than a week ago. Tomorrow will be another 2 minutes and 5 seconds shorter again, when it'll be 16 hours and 37 minutes between sunrise and sunset. Not quite what you call a grand contraction in the evening, but as the weeks go by, it'll become more and more noticeable.
Certainly will. Now, July the 14th, a couple of days away. This is in the early hours. I'm not sure what time this is going to happen, our time. I'm presuming that it is India time, early in the morning. It's to launch Chandrayaan 3, the moon lander and rover, from July the 14th, which is going to be very exciting. This is a robotic lunar lander and rover that make up the Chandrayaan 3 mission. And they're stacked atop their launch vehicle, Mark 3, LVM-3, at the Satish Dhawan Space Center. And they put this on top of that on July the 5th. So things are going well. And if all goes, of course, going, and hopefully according to plan, Chandrayaan 3 will launch on the early hours. So we better just keep an eye out on that one, see exactly what time that is. No doubt I'll get a little text or an email from you. Watch the launch. This is what I get. Yep. So Chandrayaan 1, as we remember, which launched in October 2008, sent a moon orbiter aloft in India's first ever deep space effort. So this is going to be another milestone for them as well. So we're looking forward to see what happens there. So they're having another crack at it of a moon landing very shortly. So by this time next week, we should have a little bit more news on that if everything goes to plan.
Thank you for that, John. We'll fill you in next week on the progress of that. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett, and our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032, and you can also catch us live on the World Wide Web at dublincityfm.ie and as a podcast. Now, John, of course, the search for life beyond Earth is a growing industry, shall we say, and more people seem to be getting interested in it as time goes on. And life as we know it depends on liquid water. And I see a new study has increased the probability of finding water on other worlds by a factor of 100, which generally means that the chances of finding life as we know it has also increased by a factor of 100. Now, this is all due to a new analysis that shows there are probably many more Earth-like exoplanets with liquid water than we had previously thought, and this significantly increases the chance of finding life. And the work carried out finds that even where the conditions are not ideal for liquid water to exist on the surface of the planet, many stars will harbour geological conditions suitable for water under the planet's surface. Now, we know that the presence of liquid water is essential for life, and this work shows that the water can be found in places that they had not much considered, and this significantly increases the chances of finding environments where life could, in theory, develop. So these researchers even found that if the surface of a planet is frozen, there are two main ways that enough heat can be generated to allow water to liquefy underground. Now, of course, here on Earth, we're lucky at the moment because we have just the right amount of greenhouse gases, believe it or not, but hopefully not too many more greenhouse gases. That's another story. But there's enough greenhouse gases in the atmosphere at the moment to make liquid water more stable on the surface. And if Earth were to lose its greenhouse gases, this is a new one on me, John, I didn't realise this, the average global surface temperature would be approximately minus 18 degrees, and most of the surface liquid water would completely freeze. And, of course, a few billion years ago, this is what actually happened on the planet, and the surface liquid water completely froze. Of course, this doesn't mean the water was completely frozen everywhere. So, for example, as in some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, where the surface is frozen, there are liquid oceans underneath. And this can be the same in some small planets that are close to their parent star. And we found out that there are a lot more these M-type stars, and there's a lot more of Earth-like planets orbiting these stars, and that, for example, some of the water can be liquid underneath because of the gravitational pull. In the case of Io and Enceladus, or Europa rather, and Enceladus, the gravitational tug of Jupiter is such that it's kind of molding, squishing the planet or the moon in and out. You can imagine just rolling a little orange in your palm of your hands, and you can squish it a bit and the inside liquid. Yeah. But also, the heat from radioactivity, radioactive material under the surface, can also keep water in a liquid state. And this happens to be the case, actually, in the Antarctica and also in the Canadian Arctic. So, basically what they're saying is that they think there are more planets with better conditions, more likely to have liquid water. And there seems to be 100 times more of these exoworlds than they previously thought. And therefore, in theory anyway, there's 100 times a greater chance of finding life. Now, life, they're not saying necessarily, of course, saying intelligent life, but life. And so the astrobiologists in the world would be very, very pleased. More planets to study, more data to study. And we'll keep you abreast of that one, too.
Now,
the little green men arrive.
Here's one I caught earlier on during the week. And seemingly, we're quite well used to seeing sunspots blaring out from the sun our direction. But shooting stars have been seen raining down back onto the sun for the first time. And astronomers have spotted never-before-seen meteor-like streaks seemingly rain back on the surface of the sun, evidently due to gravity. But you should think twice before attempting to catch these falling stars. And if humans were alien beings capable of living on the sun's surface, we would be constantly rewarded with amazing views of shooting stars, which is natural for something like that as well. But we wouldn't be out there for long, because these are fragments of space dust and plasma, which you don't. So the solar shooting stars are actually giant clumps of plasma dropping to the star surface at huge speeds, incredible speeds.
Yes, but that does make sense, because essentially, of course, the gravitational pull of the sun is huge, which is why it keeps all the planets in order going around it. And the more massive a body is, the greater the gravitational pull. So it makes more sense that you would have a lot more material crashing into the sun than, say, Earth. And of course, we know there's a lot more material crashes into Jupiter, which contains, apart from the sun, 66% of the mass or stuff in the whole solar system. So that does make
It makes a lot of sense. We just haven't seen it before this, and the observation was made with the European Space Agency Solar Orbiter spacecraft, and it marks the first time these impacts have been spotted. And you can actually Google things like this and just put in shooting stars seen raining down on the sun for the first time. Fantastic photographs. Fairly close up of the sun's surface as well, so you don't want to be there.
Thank you, John. Now, speaking of things, hot objects, see, there's a ESA mission an exoplanet mission, sticking with exoplanets, the CHEOPS mission, has led to the surprising revelation that an ultra-hot exoplanet that orbits its host star in less than what takes the Earth to revolve around, less than one Earth day, essentially, is covered by reflective clouds of methyl, making it the shiniest exoplanet ever found. It's like one big giant mirror the size of a planet. Now, of course, aside from the Moon, the brightest object in the sky, as we mentioned earlier, is Venus, apart from the Sun, of course, too. And if you look at Venus, it reflects about 75% of the sun's light. By comparison, Earth reflects about 30% of incoming sunlight. But now, astronomers have found an exoplanet that can is even more shinier than Venus. It has the very unromantic name of LTT9779B. I don't know how far away it is, but new detailed measurements by ESA's CHEOPS mission reveal that it reflects an amazing 80% of the light that shines upon it. And this exoplanet, they say, is around about the size of Jupiter, making it the largest mirror in the universe that we know today. And the reason for its high reflectivity is that it is covered by metallic clouds. They are mostly made of silicate, which is the same stuff that sand and glass are made of. And they think that's mixed with metals like titanium. One of the researchers says, imagine a burning world close to its star with heavy clouds of metals floating aloft, raining down titanium droplets. Well, that's what seems to be happening here. Now, the fraction of light that an object reflects is called albedo. You imagine a little black coal or carbon. That's a low albedo, and as most planets have a low albedo. But what they've done is they're looking at this shiny planet just before it disappears around the far side of the sun, and they measure the light from both of them. And then when the planet is occulted by the sun or eclipsed by the sun, they measure that tiny little drop in intensity of the light coming from it. That is, and that's basically due to the fact that that star or the planet is behind that star now, and you're not seeing that light reflected back. And from that, they reckon that the planet side facing the star is estimated to be about 2,000 degrees centigrade now. At any temperature above 100 or so, it's too hot for clouds of water to form, but the temperature of this planet's atmosphere should even be too hot for clouds of metal and or glass. And they say it's really a bit of a puzzle as to how this can be, and it shouldn't exist. But the planet is about 4.5 times bigger than Earth, and a year on this planet takes about, just under a day, an Earth day, that is, 19 hours. So it's amazing, just so hot that the clouds are gaseous metal. Okay. It's because it's so hot because it's so close to its parent star.
Yep.
We won't be going there anytime soon.
I don't think so. Not recommended. Now, just touching back on the subject that I brought up last week, was the fact that Earth's day was a constant 19.5 hours a day for over a billion years. And we're going back to the time where we're going back 2 billion years ago to 600 million years ago. And this was driven by the atmospheric tide, driven by the sun counter the effect of the moon. So the moon had a big thing to do with that. It was a lot closer to us at the time. And it kept the Earth's rotational rate steady and the length of day at a constant 19.5 hours per day. That'd make a bit of a calculation thing for the 24-hour clock, wouldn't it? Working a 19 and a half. Anyway, they say...
Well, that's 19 and a half.
Yeah.
You were probably still...
Yeah.
But that's an arbitrary figure in a way.
It is.
In a way it is. We would still have probably a 24-hour clock.
Ish.
It would just be equal to 19 hours in new money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to confuse you.
And they were saying that without this billion-year pause in the slowing of our planet's rotation, our current 24-hour day would stretch to about 60 hours. So we had that lucky pause. Imagine having a 60-hour day.
Well, we would have evolved. I think we evolved
possibly,
the way we did because, and our need for sleep and that cycle we have is because of the Earth's rotation.
Mm. And what's your view on AI now, the artificial intelligence? This is getting very serious at the moment.
I don't know.
Will is really...
Well, I find it ironic when sometimes when you log onto websites, you're asked by a computer program or a bot to prove that you're human. You know, when you have to tick a box or tick all those squares where there's a motorbike or I am not a robot, or those pictures, which ones contain the cars or the traffic lights or whatever.
Bridges, whatever.
Anyway, it's a computer asking you to prove you're not...
Yeah, well, we have
that you are human.
Robots in space on the space station, etc. They're creeping up everywhere. They're getting more intelligent. Now, will they take over? I don't know. But the warnings are coming from all angles. Artificial intelligence poses an existential risk to humanity and must be shackled before it's too late. So that's the word. Paperclips of doom is what they call it. So over the next coming years and years, I presume that robots will get more intelligent. They won't allow us to turn them off.
Very some horror stories, I suppose, in some respects about AI and what it could do. Somebody posed to me once, says, what happens if AI is running a hospital, and for example, and one machine says you need such an operation, and then the computer that's running the financial side of things looks at things. What age are they? What are their health condition? Not worth the financially. Turn off life support. That would be maybe that's a is that too much scaremongering, that you could have a machine deciding whether you live or die?
I don't know. It's something we have to look at. So the warnings are out there. And you heard it from us as well.
So remember where you heard it first.
We've one thing to do. Now, you picked this up earlier on. It was about a meteor that hit way back in...
But not too long ago, about 6 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, January the 8th in 2014. It was the size of a kitchen sink. Now, we were trying to discuss whether it was a Belfast sink or a big metal sink or with twin drainers or anything. It doesn't really matter. And it entered our atmosphere on the 8th of January 2014. It was detected by American spy satellites. And this was in Papua New Guinea. Now, seemingly, it's gone missing. And it was at the bottom of the sea, and nobody gave permission to do that. So they're desperately trying to find out where this kitchen sink went. Now, seemingly they dredged the area with a big magnet because it would have been magnetic as well. So who to blame?
There are people who are being, the finger is being pointed at, and the powers that be in Papua New Guinea are saying, oh, come on, that's ours. And there's... But the people who dredge it up say, oh, this could be proof of alien life. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we get to that some other time. The other thing I did want to get to, but I don't have time, but I know we covered it before, about using huge solar panels in space to beam the energy down to Earth. And they would be so far out that they would be, they would never be in darkness. They'd always be directly facing the sun. So you'd have the solar panels be working 24/7, and then using a certain method to beam the energy back down, but to Earth. Well, unfortunately, don't have time to go through that this evening. That's all the time we have, I think. Yes, it'll be overtime because we're getting into trouble.
A big one from Alan there. Excellent work tonight, man. Shone brighter than Venus itself.
I was
wondering if he was listening or not. So there you go. Hey, good evening to you,
thank
sir.
You, Alan.
Yeah, evidently the reception is good down there.
Oh, that's good. Thank you for that. Thank you, John, for your news items and for driving the sound desk. Don't forget our email address is astronomy@dublincityofm.ie. Thanks to John, of course, and to James Sweeney and to Conor Lennon. But that's all for me, Ben Emmett, for this edition of The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up next, it's Hello China. And then at 9 p.m, we have Bren Lynott with Threads. And at 11 p.m, it's Nigel Wood's World of Music, Ear to the Globe. And from midnight to 2 a.m, it's Dave Barry's mix of jazz, blues and soul in a program called After Hours. But please join myself and John at the same time next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening and say goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.